justice and justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session for the judge of the term.
Good morning, be seated, please.
I don't know, but probably the best in case.
First case in our calendar is 96-28-19-97-52. State of Ohio versus Jerry Hessler, Ms. Kochow.
Attention to the rules?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Doesn't the rule specifically say that at the end of the trial, the alternate jurors shall be discharged?
The trial wasn't over at that point, however, because they still had the sentencing phase to do, Your Honor. But
the guilt phase was over.
The guilt phase was over, yes, Your Honor. After speaking with Juror Wolford, the trial court knew that she did not agree with the other jurors and should have sentenced Jerry Hessler to a life sentence. Juror Wolford told the court that she did not agree with any of those people in there. Prior to speaking with the court, Wolford had been in the jury room deliberating on the appropriate sentence in this case. Her comments only meant that she did not agree with the other jurors' sentencing recommendation. There was any doubt that that was the meaning of Wolford's comment. She clarified it when three times she asked the trial court what would happen if she rejected the jury's verdict. This record demonstrates that Wolford did not agree with the other jurors. Brooklyn Springer tell us that when a jury decides to impose death, it has to be unanimously defined as the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors.
But didn't the trial court repeatedly tell her that she didn't do what she felt was right? The court continued to bolster her ability to make her own decisions rather than that the consequences of the wrong court, not on her.
The court did tell her a little bit. And we tried to encourage her not to feel pressure at the time. The problem is that without the trial court understanding what happened in the jury room, the issue of course and misconduct, it couldn't know that what it told her Wolford would cure that problem.
But how do we get around the invasion of the jury room when we start inquiring into what happened?
statement.
Who said that you're doing?
No, Your Honor, because the trial court learned about the misconduct, the potentiality for misconduct prior to the jury announcing its sentencing recommendation. What the case law says at that point is that the Allende rule does not apply. You look at cases like U.S. versus Sotelo. During jury deliberations, the court is informed that racial remarks are being made during deliberations. The court made inquiry into those allegations. You see that in cases from New York and New Jersey where the trial court is alerted during deliberations to problems and doesn't take action to address them, but the defendant's convictions are reversed.
Are you suggesting, which is the following two, are you suggesting that the judge should have called the entire jury out and discussed this matter with them to see if they were exerting pressure, or should he have replaced this juror with an alternate?
I don't think that the trial court had enough information at that point to decide that it should replace the juror. What was called for was a rumor here, Your Honor, to determine what happened, its impact on the jury, and whether Jerry Huff was raised or prejudiced. The record in this case suggests a strong possibility that Juror Wolfman was coerced and that she did not agree that this was the appropriate verdict. If you look at the actions that she took, she led the jury room in tears and refused to return to the jury room with other jurors. Highly emotional. She said she could not handle the pressure, that she was going crazy. She complained about the behaviors of other jurors, and she told the court that she did not.
That doesn't necessarily mean she would have voted for life. That just means, these are terribly emotional ordeals for jurors, and I frequently encounter jurors in far less cases than that in people's citizen same behavior. That may mean that they regret the terrible position on them to make such horrible decisions. That's a pretty inferential leap that those actions meant she would have voted the opposite way.
Your Honor, what the actions imply is that the possibility was there that Wolfer was coerced and that misconduct was committed. That's why the rumor hearing is necessary. We don't know for a fact that Juror Wolfer was coerced or that misconduct was committed. That's why the rumor hearing is necessary. That's the whole point of the rumor hearing, to determine what happened, impact on the jury, and whether Jerry Huff was right or prejudiced. Without that hearing to develop the necessary facts, we're speculating. But the facts normally suggest the possibility of misconduct. Again, this is a very unusual case. We were juror leaving the jury room and accusing the jury, complaining about the behavior of other jurors, and indicating to the court that the primary jury and asking what would happen if she rejected the jury's verdict. The implication is there that jurors did not agree with the other jurors and that she was coerced into finding a verdict form that she did not agree with. What the Supreme Court said in U.S. versus Tanner is that one of the defendant's Sixth Amendment protections against juror misconduct was the juror's ability to alert the trial court prior to the verdict of any inappropriate behavior. Such an alert provides no protection to the defendant when the court simply ignores it, which is what happened in this case. For the court, what the Supreme Court expected to happen was that action be taken. And Tanner, the court cited to Lee versus U.S. In that case, the trial court is alerted during deliberations that the jury wishes to change foreperson and also that a juror may be intoxicated. In response to those allegations, the court questioned each juror and then took action to address the situation. That's what was called for in this instance. The court needed to assess what happened and address the problem as possible. A rumor hearing should have helped to determine what happened, the impact on the jury, and whether Jerry Huff's rights were prejudiced.
Counsel, after the verdict, the jury came in and announced its verdict. Was there a request by either side to have the jury polled?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that done?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what was the outcome of that polling of the jury?
All of the jurors agreed that it was their verdict.
Okay. Was the juror in question asked that question?
Yes.
Did she say anything?
She said it was her verdict.
Did she complain that she was coerced or forced into that verdict?
Not at that point, no.
So in open court, when she had the chance, she stated that the verdict that was rendered by the other jurors was her verdict also.
Yes.
Don't you think that colloquy may have cured any other possible problems with the verdict that went on before that?
In this case, I don't believe it does, Your Honor. If you look at Juror Wolfert's affidavit, which counsel submitted after it learned what had occurred during the deliberations, Wolfert said she was too afraid to stand up in the courtroom in front of all of these people and the cameras to say that it wasn't her verdict.
But she did say that, and she had the opportunity to do that. She obviously complained to the court, did she not?
Yes.
And did she complain to other people also?
Prior to announcing the polling?
Yeah.
The only person that I'm aware that she talked to based on this record is the trial court.
Okay. So we have on the records stating that, yes, this is her verdict, and without any other additional explanation as to how she arrived at that verdict.
Well, we have...
Don't you want... do we just discard that?
I think in this case, the court should consider that. The court should not ignore what happened prior to the jury agreeing that this was her verdict during polling. She fled the jury room in tears. She complained about the behaviors of the other jurors. She told the court she didn't agree with the verdict.
I just want to know how we treat what she said in open court.
I don't think that it should be positive of this issue, Your Honor.
Can we discard it?
What the Constitution requires is that all 12 jurors be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors.
But in order for you and for us to throw out the verdict, we have to discard what she said in open court on the record.
I don't believe you have to do that, Your Honor. I believe you have to consider the entire sequence of events. If Juror Wolfert signed that verdict form and agreed that it was her verdict because she was coerced...
So we have to go through a weighing process as to what phase we believe and what phase we disbelieve?
No, what I think is appropriate is that this case be remanded to the trial court for an evidentiary hearing on this issue. There simply aren't enough facts to determine if Wolfert was coerced into assenting to this verdict, and if there was juror misconduct committed. Because if Juror Wolfert signed that verdict form and agreed during polling that this was her verdict, because she was coerced, that verdict should not be treated as a valid verdict. We require all 12 jurors to be convinced. If Juror Wolfert assented to the verdict because she was afraid, because she was coerced, because of misconduct, that verdict should not be treated as valid.
But we would have to disregard this whole dialogue that went on with the judge and Ms. Wolfert. There's an extensive dialogue about all of this, and she said the only thing she really said she didn't agree with all those people, and she couldn't take, I do not agree with any of the people in there. They're all like, you know, I can't handle the pressure. You know, I cannot be around that. Okay, let's just do it. Okay, I'm upset. I don't want to do it. I cannot do it. Yet she never told the judge in that dialogue outright that it was not her verdict.
And the judge never asked her, Your Honor. This is the problem throughout this proceeding, is that the facts weren't developed. What was necessary was a rumor hearing. Again, the juror will need to be asked what happened. There's a lot of ambiguity, but she makes comments that suggest that she was coerced and suggest that misconduct may have been committed. And in that instance, a rumor hearing is appropriate to determine what happened, the impact on the jury, and whether Jerry Hessler's right for prejudice.
The judge reminded her of the oath. He told her that only you can make the decision, you know, without specifically asking the question. He did everything else in his power.
I don't necessarily agree that that's true, Your Honor, because Juror Wolfert asked the court three times what would happen if she rejected the jury's verdict. The court obviously wasn't giving her an answer that she felt satisfied with questions that she had. You looked at Juror Wolfert back in the day, but she was afraid she would be punished if she went into court and rejected the jury's verdict. You think about the latest experience of signing documents. If she signed something and then later said, no, I didn't mean it, she could get in trouble for that.
Excuse me, you keep referring to the jury's verdict. That she was afraid to reject the jury's verdict. The jury's verdict was guilty.
Correct.
You're talking about the sentencing phase. Okay, so it's not the verdict.
No, it's the sentencing.
That's the reason, because the rule specifically says and I don't know why you don't emphasize it even more. It says, an alternate juror who does not replace a regular juror shall be discharged after the jury retires to consider, not its sentencing recommendation, its verdict. And the verdict is guilty or not guilty, right? Okay, now let me ask another procedural question. On page 118 of your brief, you say, it's apparent on the face of the record here, therefore Hessler requests that his convictions and sentences be vacated, case be remanded to the trial court. You aren't really here asking us to reverse the conviction, are you? On the face of all this evidence?
Not as to proposition of law number two, if that's what you're referring to. The appropriate remedy in that case would either be to vacate the judgment that has been imposed by life sentences or remand for a remand hearing.
But are you on any other fact asking us to reverse this conviction in the face of this overwhelming evidence and admissions and all of that?
Proposition of law number one, Your Honor, deals with the flawed reasonable doubt instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And in that proposition, we do request that the convictions be vacated and that the case be remanded for a new trial.
I know that's your job. How would that look to an ever suspecting and maybe properly suspecting public? You just think about the fact that we have it clear with all of this evidence. I recognize the argument with regard to the sentence. But if you're here asking for the trial to be set aside and have a new trial, that's a whole different ballgame to me.
It's very different, I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
The problem with the flawed reasonable doubt instruction, however, is that it's a structural error that impacts the integrity of the trial. I think it's very important to everyone in society to know that when they go into a criminal court, that the jury will be required to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Just as important in a case where there's a significant amount of evidence against the defendant, we allow an jury Hessler to be convicted when the jury was required to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That jeopardizes the potentiality for it to happen in another case.
Is there any doubt, just reasonable without any doubt, that this defendant shot Brian, Tracy, and Amanda? Any doubt?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
The problem, however, is that...
Shot and killed them.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The problem, however, is that the jury has to be told to find that he was guilty of every element of the charge before he can be convicted. That's what we require of every for every defendant who goes into court. It doesn't matter what the crime is, they have to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the jury isn't required to find guilt in that manner, that violates the Constitution. However, the remainder of the brief is devoted strictly to sentencing issues, and in particular the issue of juror misconduct and coercion in this case.
Counsel, after having reviewed the entire record, would have been the appropriate course of conduct, assuming that you are correct that the juror was intimidated, being coerced, all of those things. Some of the best possible facts situation for your client.
I think what the court should have done is to conduct the evidentiary hearing.
Okay, let's assume the judge finds that there is inappropriate coercion from the person who's recommended for them.
At that point, I'm not entirely sure what the best course of action would be. The facts aren't there to know. It's possible that a strongly worded admonition to the jury about the misconduct and about the proper course that the jury should take in deliberation would be sufficient. That's happened in some of the cases that I've reviewed. It may be possible that because of misconduct and because of coercion, that jury could never have come to a fair and reliable sentence in this case.
You want us to assume that this juror was totally intimidated, saying, I just can't stand being in that jury room trying to stand up to these people and they're angry at the judge. Let's assume it has a hearing and
that's exactly what's going on. It doesn't, the jurors and the defense counsel, excusing that juror and allowing alternate jurors to be substituted for the remainder of deliberations doesn't really solve the problem, does it?
I don't think it necessarily does, Your Honor. Again, the problem is that we don't have all the facts here to know precisely what occurred because the rumor hearing wasn't held. That jury panel may have been so tainted because of coercion and conduct that it could never reach a fair and reliable.
So then what is the judge doing?
At that point, that's a very different position than what we're in, so I'm struggling with an answer.
Asking us to write something that is instructive to,
right,
to judges facing this problem. I mean, this had to be a real tough problem for that judge facing this. Okay, so where's the roadmap? Assuming the scenario that you want us to assume, where do you go?
It's going to be very fact-specific is the problem, Your Honor. What the court needs to do is make the inquiry to determine what happened, its impact on the jury, and whether the defendant's rights were prejudiced. It's possible that the entire panel would need to be dismissed, and at that point, the statute would take over. If there's not a jury available to sentence, could the courts work near a new panel and select a new jury? If the penance were repealed, it seems like that might be a possibility. The other alternative would simply leave it in the trial court's hands at that point to determine which sentence is appropriate. But I think with the penance repeal, it could be appropriate to...
Is death off the table at that point then?
I think death is off the table in this case because Juror Wolfer said she did not agree with the other jurors. And at that point, you have a jury that is not unanimous. And at that
the dilemma here is defense counsel doesn't want to get rid of this juror because intuitively defense counsel is going to assume this is a holdout juror or no death in this case. So everybody's in the box. The judge is in the box. The defense counsel's in the box. Because the defense counsel is concluding, you're taking some leaps of faith here, and we all would in that situation, including this is my client's last best and only love to keep this girl. So now. What the judge just has to take over at that point because the judge isn't really going to get the guidance that he or she even needs from the defense counsel.
I think what the court needed to do at this point, again, is hold the Bremer hearing. It knew there was a problem in that attempt in the jury room. There were suggestions of coercion, there were suggestions of misconduct. And what the court needed to do was establish what precisely did happen. It's possible that the court may have come back after conducting the inquiry to find that there wasn't coercion, that this was just heated deliberation. The problem is that without the inquiry, we can't be certain that that's true. In U.S. versus the South, the trial court made the inquiry into the racial remarks allegations that a juror made and found there was no basis for
them. In the initial contact with the juror, the judge, it would be inappropriate, if not for the judge to say, to inquire as to whether or not, you know, what's really going on here? Is this juror the holdout juror? Is everybody else ready to close death? And you're not. To get into that would be an invasion of the jury's process.
I don't think that the court needs to ask for you a holdout to determine if there was misconduct going on in the jury room without asking her what her position was. What's the problem? She could explain that without saying what her position was, what the other juror's position was. Where, in New Jersey versus Virgilia, the court talked to the juror during deliberations to indicate that he was being pressured to change his vote, that he was suffering from a great amount of stress because of that. You can discuss what's going on without saying, my position is death, my position is life. So he didn't necessarily have to know which juror was voting to be able to determine what precisely happened, how it impacted on the jury, and whether Jerry Hess was right or prejudiced. That's an alternative argument in this court finding, to this court deciding that Juror Wolford's statement that she didn't agree with the other jurors and a repeated inquiry into what would happen if she rejected the jury's verdict, that that wasn't a rejection of the jury's verdict, which would require the court to impose a life sentence.
Is the standard of review for a trial court faced with whatever circumstances, the circumstances here being the juror rushing from the room and saying what she said, is the standard of review for the court to determine whether or not there's enough to warrant a Remmer hearing abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the other proposition here, is that if there was sufficient evidence at that time for the court to make the inquiry into what happened, its impact on the jury, and whether Jerry Hussler's rights were prejudiced, then this case should be remanded for the trial court to conduct that hearing. There was sufficient evidence, I believe, based on Wolford's action in fleeing the jury room, her comments to the court, and her distressed demeanor. The trial court really had two opportunities here to salvage the proceedings. First, Juror Wolford said she didn't agree with the other jurors, and the trial court could have imposed a life sentence, but didn't. Second, when the trial court was confronted with the complaints and the serious suggestion that misconduct may have been committed, the court could have granted the evidentiary hearing, but didn't. What the court told us in New Jersey versus Virgilio is that a verdict of 11 jurors with a 12 vote coerced rather than convinced is no verdict at all. Jerry Hussler's death sentence rests on such verdict. Therefore, he respectfully requests that this court vacate his death sentences and impose life sentences, or alternatively, in this case, be remanded to the trial court for an evidentiary hearing on the issue of juror misconduct.
Thank you, Ms. Bourgeois. Ms. Anderson.
Himself. He went after everyone against whom he had ever had a grudge. The juror, Ms. Kulshaw, is making a number of assumptions that are unsupported by the record. The one she is assuming that the trial court should have known when the juror came out into the hallway that the juror didn't want the death penalty. When in fact, from what the juror said, the juror could just as easily have been the only one who did want the death penalty.
But why shouldn't the trial judge, regardless of how the juror is thinking about the juror's ultimate decision, why shouldn't the trial judge hold a Remmer hearing where a juror appears to be obviously under duress from fellow jurors? Why isn't the simple answer to this to just hold the hearing?
Excuse me, Your Honor, I'm sorry. The simple answer in this case is because the defense attorney asked him to do what he did. He came out and he said, the foreman tells me there's a problem, there's a juror in the hall crying, I propose to go back and talk to her, what do you think? And the defense attorney said, yes, I think you should do that. That's the simple answer for this case. The more complicated answer for cases in general is that the court certainly may hold such a hearing if the court wishes.
But at what point do the circumstances require a hearing? I mean, that's the line that's being asked to be drawn. At what point do circumstances...
Well, you're asking me what is abuse of discretion, and in some ways it's like a sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
We can only say that this particular court did not abuse its discretion. I would think, for example, if the juror ran into the hall and the court came in and said, we've got a jury back in the hall crying, let's go bring her in here and let's hear them, let's pull the jury and find out what the verdict is. So perhaps that would be an abuse of discretion where he literally did not inquire at all. However, I don't know how a court could, based on this record, say that this judge abused his discretion when there was an obvious concern for this particular juror. He actually went out and talked to her twice. He went out the first time after saying to the lawyers, what should I do? And they both said, yes, go talk to her. He went out and talked to her. She said, I don't agree with the other people in there. She never said I don't agree with her.
There was a reporter?
Yes, there was a report, and there is a complete record from which this court can judge. She said the court did, in a roundabout way, ask, well, what is the problem? And she said, they're mean and rude. But she never said anything about any threats, and even the affidavit, which Ms. Colshaw claimed that the court ought to consider, never said she was threatened. Regarding the Rule 24, Judge, in answer to your question about the alternate jurors, it was, at this time, a common practice to send the alternate jurors back into the jury room, and the defense attorney in this case did agree. It is no longer a common practice because of the United States Supreme Court, the name of which escapes me at the moment, and does something.
What about our rule?
And our rule, and the case out of this court, I believe it's Holloway, that was decided after this case was tried. So no, we don't do that anymore. We should have done it then, but the defense attorney agreed.
But the rule is clear, isn't it?
Well, it seems clear now in retrospect. But
I've never seen it done any other way until we started getting some of these cases. I mean, with every trial I ever held, after the trial is over, the alternate jurors are discharged.
Obviously, it was not clear to a lot of trial lawyers at that time. I can't speak for the trial lawyers who did this.
Well, isn't the problem that in a death case, the rule doesn't seem to
anticipate
a death case?
Doesn't cover it.
Usually, the verdict is the end of the jury's work. The jury doesn't recommend a sentence except in death cases, so the rules, but it does certainly say verdict.
And there are cases that have said now that the jurors should have been dismissed and that this particular proceeding should no longer be followed and is no longer followed. However, at the time I remember reading transcripts where trial courts were saying, well, yeah, but what happens if somebody gets sick and then we have to start all over and we've just been through 3 months and I don't want to do this again. And so perhaps they were being deliberately myopic.
Or maybe we should change the rule.
You could change the rule to provide for death penalty cases. But in answer to your response to your question about why, if the rule is so clear, why did trial judges do it? Perhaps they were being deliberately myopic because they were thinking, I don't want to sit through another 3 months of this case. I don't want to start over. I cannot answer this. I can't say we don't do it this way anymore.
Someplace I remember in the conversation between the judge and the court, you seemed to indicate that she was not under any duress or at least under any threat. I can't find it right now, but I remember reading that colloquy that went on between them, and I remember, I think, that she said, they're all screaming at me. They're hollering at me. They'll think I'm crazy.
She said they're all screaming at me. I do remember something about crazy. I don't remember exactly. I'm going crazy, I think is what she said. Not they don't think I'm crazy, but I'm going crazy.
The exact words are, everyone will think I'm crazy. Okay? I understand. But I'm even more concerned about I suppose she's thinking that people will think she's crazy if she says that he's not guilty. With 6 murders or whatever number it is, but I really am concerned about how it was handled with her too, as well as the other people that have expressed their concern, because the judge very clearly never said to her, he kept saying, okay, I'm going to send you back in and you have to answer this question. And finally she understood and said, you mean you're going to ask us all individually?
But I do believe that he did say that there will be a jury poll. And she said, oh, we're going to all ask individually. And he said, yes.
That was the third time. Third time he said, she said, oh, you mean individually? So jury poll to them means is this all your verdict? Everybody says yes.
Actually, Your Honor, when I read that, I thought that she seemed relieved that they were going to all be asked individually.
Hmm.
Now, I do not have it in front of me, so I don't remember what the exact words were. But
well, the court said, do you understand, Maravon? I will ask that question. Do you understand, Ms. Wolford? Yes. You are going through everybody? No. that inflection shouldn't have been there.
You're going through everybody? But that showed that she was relieved that everyone was going to be asked, not just her, but that everyone was going to be asked the question that she was not going to be singled out and somehow being upset.
I see. That's a legitimate...
That's the impression that I got when I read that.
Okay.
And, but the most important thing, I think, in the colloquy with the judge is where the judge says, once or twice, nobody can make the decision for you. It's up to you. And in response to the question of, well, what will happen if I say no, the judge really couldn't tell her at that point because he didn't really know. And if they had gone into the jury and she had said, no, I've changed my mind, it's not my verdict, well, the defense attorney might have asked for a mistrial, or the defense attorney might have asked that she be instructed and sent back, or he might have, because as one of you said, he wants her. She obviously has a problem. He doesn't want to get rid of her. So the court really didn't know what might happen if she said this is not your verdict, except that something would have happened. And he therefore, I believe quite correctly, said, well, that's not for you to worry about. What you need to worry about is what you believe. No one can make the decision for you. It's all of you. It's your decision. It's what matters to you. Don't worry about anything else.
The Chief Justice raised the issue very, very properly about shouldn't it have rung a bell and said we ought to have a hearing. And I thought, when I read it, it was kind of a hearing, even though it was, you know, in chambers and just with her. Until I got to when she said, yes, but I have to go home. I need to go home for my kids. Okay, I guess I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
Well, that, there was some more after that. The court then said, now wait a minute. No. For the third time, you went through it. The court then went on, wait a minute, I want to make sure that you're relaxed, I want to make sure that you understand, I want to make sure that it's your verdict. The same might be said of any juror, that there might be some juror in there that would rather watch the ball game.
Marvin, time is not consequential. What is important, Marvin, Mrs. Wolford, it is to me. I want to get out of this room. I want to go home. My kids are waiting for me. Put me back in there. Ask me the question, and I'll answer. Not about you. You could read it your way, but you could read it that way too, could you?
Well, yes. I would say only that the standard is abuse of discretion. Certainly, the court could have gone back. Again, I'll also point out that the defense attorney asked the court to do it this way. And when the court came back and said, after the brief discussion, the court came back again and said, well, she says they're mean and rude and what do I do now? And the defense attorney said, well, did she sign the verdict form? Yes. Did she say it was her verdict? Well, not exactly. Did she say what she would say in response to the being called? No, she didn't say. Well, why don't you go back and ask? And went back. He didn't exactly ask that way. He told her there would be a poll and that everyone would be, well, she would not be singled out, everyone would be asked. And he came back again into the courtroom and said, she's not telling me what she'll say. And the defense attorney at that point says, well, I think I have to move for a mistrial because this has never happened before. And the court, again, properly, I believe, said, well, at this point, I have no grounds for a mistrial because she hadn't told me that it's not her verdict. Now, if she had come back and said, no, it's not my verdict, then the court may well have granted the defense attorney's mistrial. And I do agree that it could have been, that a new jury could have been impaneled on the death penalty since the statutes have changed after Penix. For that matter, I suppose the court could have declared a mistrial, the whole thing, and started over if they wanted to. The court has a great deal of discretion in this kind of area.
Counsel, isn't it consistent to them? Isn't that really the problem here? Both attorneys say their agenda is prosecution, what's it? Death penalty. At this stage in the case, we've already got the conviction. The defense counsel, any way they got there, juror, they want this process to go on, and the jury be deadlocked on the subject of death, and so they have to set down to another. And the judge really has to take over at some point. And I want to come back to Justice Cook's question, which her question really was not, what is abuse of discretion? I think her question was, in the abstract, what do we tell trial judges? At what point is there enough going on here with the juror that we say you need to get to a hearing, not whether or not it's an abuse of discretion that you did or did not do it in a particular fact situation, but in the abstract, take out the abuse of discretion, how much more would you need before you recognize the obvious full-blown hearing here?
That the court is in a position to say if one, two, three things happen, then by the court you must hold a hearing.
Well, we've got a pretty unpleasant fact pattern here.
Well, Your Honor, once again, I don't find it all that ugly. I agree with Justice Stratton that jurors get upset all the time. That's why we have Rule 606. It's fairly unusual that they go screaming into the hallways, but it happens fairly often that they're screaming in the jury room and people in the courtroom can hear them.
They're screaming, they're laughing, I mean, there's a lot of emotion.
It happens fairly often.
When a juror just busts out of the room and is sitting there crying in the hallway, that...
Well, it's a little more unusual, but it also happens in almost, in many, many post-conviction petition cases. There are affidavits of jurors attached saying, I was coerced into this verdict.
Okay, so if she went down the stairs and got in her car and the bailiff had to bring her back, that would be.
Oh, well, yes, she just ran out of the courthouse, but then certainly something has to happen.
Use one of the alternate jurors.
Who hadn't been distracted.
Well, Your Honor,
yeah, who hadn't been distracted.
They won't be there now. I can't answer your question. If you're asking for what directions we give trial court.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask you, is there a bright line?
I don't think so. I think that the best you can do is face trial court if we're concerned about this. Make sure that you take it seriously and there is a right. There might be a right line if you want to set it. You can say whenever a juror comes out and says, that's not a problem, we must want to hear.
That's what I was going to say. Perhaps we could eliminate all these problems at any time a situation like this arises. There should be a hearing held, and then it would be a uniform practice across the state.
That is a bright line. I would say that I would not limit it to a situation like this. I would just say if the court wants to, the court can say, whenever the jury comes out and says one of the jurors doesn't agree, they must have a hearing. I'm not sure whether that's a good idea, because I suspect that you would have a hearing in just about every case there is, especially death penalty cases, because the emotions run so much higher in those cases than in others.
But this is the first case, I think, that we've seen. Maybe it's not the first, but where the juror in a distraught condition says that she does not agree with the other jurors, that she doesn't know what will happen if I don't agree with the verdict, and then she said, I want to go home, okay, send me back in. I mean, it's all of the indications that she didn't agree, she was holding out, but finally she decided it's more important to me to get home, get out of the situation, so I'll go in and sure, I'll vote for death, and that gets me out of the situation. This is in the context, unfortunately for you, this is in the context of this is the third or fourth case we've had in the last 6 or 7 months in which, not death cases, but in which juror, I'll call it misconduct, but where there's been some problem with the jury, and we've been attempting to find what our role is in telling trial courts what you do with a difficult situation for a trial judge, because the sanctity of the jury, of course, is fundamental to our system. And so we have to be sensitive, it seems to me, to be certain to say that when a jury renders a verdict or makes a recommendation, as it does here, that that's based upon the best conduct of the jurors, that that's done in a process in which every juror is free to state his or her position and vote the way they want to. And that's why this case is, I think that's why you're seeing the questions you are. This seems to attack that basic premise of the system. And
I agree, Your Honor, that it is a definite problem. And in fact, in Stan versus the United States, Judge O'Connor said that no doubt inquiry of the sort, inquiry into the jury's deliberations would discover a good bit of misconduct. But it is not at all clear that the jury system would survive such efforts to prevent it. Close quote. It is obviously a problem, but once you get into the legal inquiry into the deliberations of the jury, then you're going to have a trial in every case, a second trial, or a fourth.
Well, first, this is not going to the jury room and sort of tearing back the screen, it's responding to something that became very public, isn't it? And the juror obviously.
Well, Your Honor,
the judge didn't have to go into the court and into the jury room to find the problem. The juror stated the problem. That's the problem. I think that's how this
she said they were mean and rude.
Well, she said what do I do if I don't agree with their verdict and I don't agree with them, I think. I mean, that's what.
She said, I don't agree with them, but she didn't say it about what.
Maybe about their conduct, I suppose, but I think
I don't agree with them because they're mean and rude. Yeah. They should be more polite to me.
Perhaps, but.
If you're asking what you could say in the future to judges, as Judge Redmond said, if you could say it whenever there is a mention, then you must hold a hearing. However, before you say that, I would ask the court to consider Tanner versus United States and what Judge O'Connor had to say about the jury system and could it survive such a rule.
A suggestion has been made and you have somewhat concurred in it, and I wanted to explore that with you before you sat down, Ms. Anderson, because I don't know that I agree with that. The Remmer case, I don't think, says there has to be a hearing. I think it says there should be a hearing when there is jury misconduct. Is this jury misconduct?
No, there's nothing that shows on the track.
Clearly isn't.
Jury misconduct. And in Renner, also, by the way, there was outside evidence. A juror, in Renner, incredible case, a juror went to the judge and said, a stranger came up to me and said, if I voted to acquit the defendant, there was money in it for me. And the judge told the prosecutor and the FBI, and they went back into the jury room and talked to the jurors, and it apparently never occurred to the judge to tell the defense attorney. Now that is an abuse of discretion.
But that smacks, forgetting the abuse of discretion, that smacks of juror misconduct who may have been influenced one way or the other with the money proposition.
It's an outside influence more than juror misconduct, because the juror did what the juror should have done.
I mean, here the juror didn't misconduct herself. She did what she thought she believed.
Well, the defense attorney, of course, is claiming that the other jurors misconducted themselves by
coercion.
Well,
the worst, that would be the argument. Yeah.
Nothing in the record to show coercion.
Well, but that happened. That happens a lot. When they negotiate, some people would call it coercion.
Some people would call it coercion. And once again, Justice O'Connor and Tanner talks about we want a free and fair discussion. We want an open discussion. One of the remarks in the affidavit, which we would contend that this court cannot consider, but nevertheless, the trial court did consider the affidavit in the motion for new trial that they filed. And one of the remarks was that one of the jurors had said, well, we're not considering mitigation. He did it to get the death penalty. That might have happened. I don't know. And another juror might just as well have jumped in and said, no. Remember the instructions. You can't do that. And I'm sure that the jurors say all kinds of things back there.
In a situation such as this one where it's alleged that there's coercion going on in the jury room on the part of the other jurors, how can a court determine that without holding hearing. Does the court just disregard it?
I think that the trial court has to do what the trial court did and ask for what is
and
the
make the, make the decision from that interview, that particular hearing.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so. Now, I think that the trial court would have discretion to then go back in and inquire of the other jurors. During trial, this is Ms. Kushal's real problem, is that during trial, the trial court did what the defense attorney asked it to do. And so what she's trying to do now is get around Rule 606. But during trial, I think the court has discretion to go ask the jurors about it. I'm not sure if it might be a better idea to do what Ms. Kushal suggested and to bring everybody back in and say, why don't we take a 30-minute break? There seems to be a lot of bad feelings. Everybody should try to be nice, play nice. And the court could have done that, perhaps. And there's a lot the court could have done. But to say that the trial court used its discretion when it was obvious that the trial court expressed a great deal of concern for the juror and did what the defense attorney suggest that would be going too far in this case. If for future cases you want to stay for future instruction, you're certainly free to do that.
That's your argument, that the trial court did what the defense counsel asked him to do is we recognize waiver of law, probably maybe more than we should, but does the trial court have a higher duty, responsibility to be sure that again, the sanctity of the jury, that when the jury renders a decision, that process has been pursuant to the basic fundamentals of how we think juries should function, or is it sufficient that the trial judge simply take his or her cue from counsel, as long as they're satisfied, that's sufficient? Do you think the trial judge has a higher responsibility to be sure that the jury functions the way a jury should function?
As opposed to what the defense attorney wants to do?
Yes.
And I believe that the court meant that.
So your argument, you're not resting entirely on the fact that the defense counsel was satisfied, or that the trial judge did what the defense counsel suggested he do, but that what he did was sufficient to satisfy.
That's correct.
But isn't there a duty on the trial counsel to inform the court that they feel what the court is about to do is wrong, and that giving the court an opportunity to reconsider what they're about to do? Don't they have an obligation to voice their concern to the trial court and not just sit there idly and let the court do something that they feel is wrong?
Yes, but, Your Honor, the defense attorney did not sit there idly. He said, yes, Your Honor, I think you should do that.
I understand that, but there is an obligation on counsel.
Certainly.
To talk with
Certainly.
The court and to make sure that if in their opinion the trial court's making a mistake,
that
they just can't sit there idly and let the court make a mistake and then benefit from that mistake later.
Of course, and the court said that in State v. Williams. Also, I refer the court to State v. Rowe, which Ms. Kushal cited, I did not, in which court held that the waiver on the presence of the defendant, that they could waive that by saying nothing. In this particular case, the defense attorney asked the court to do it. The defendant was also in the courtroom. The defendant said nothing. This is what they asked him to do. And I agree that is not the only consideration. When I read this colloquy between the trial court and the juror, it seemed clear to me that the court was very concerned about her. I think that, now obviously things are open to differing interpretations, as Justice Douglas and I discussed earlier, but I thought that there was a great deal of concern being expressed for her. because he kept saying, if you want water, I want you to give it less, if you want to wait for a while, what can we do for you to make it easier for you?
Would it be inappropriate at that point for the judge instead of going in full-blown hearing. A, he knows this juror that he's not on the if he just brought the whole jury out, the back of the box, maybe gave them a little lecture on stability, and then reread the charge insofar as it relates to the value of life of the person. Because to go much further, it really does involve an inquiry as to the status of the deliberation assessment.
I don't think, again, Your Honor, you see the court's hearing is over and over in the case that Mr. Hessler cited to, that prior to the return of the verdict, they've been willing to talk to jurors to develop that, even when it has to do with improper conduct during the jury deliberation. I don't think that the court could know that recharging the jury would cure whatever problem had occurred before. You simply don't know how to deal with the coercion or the misconduct if you don't understand what happened. The trial court needed to make the inquiry to determine what happened, how it impacted the jurors, before it could craft a remedy for the situation if one could be crafted. Is there any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Michelle. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.